This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 128, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. My mission here at the Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases and other related events. And you can enjoy the extended version of this episode ad-free, along with over 100 hours of extended episodes on Patreon. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe. This week I'm talking to Jeffrey Mishlove and Russell Targ about their book, Russell Targ, 90 Years of Remote Viewing, ESP and Timeless Awareness. Russell Targ is a physicist and author who devoted much of his professional career to the research of psychic ability. In 1972, he co-founded the Stanford Research Institute's federally funded Stargate program that investigated psychic abilities. The program provided invaluable remote viewing techniques to various government intelligence agencies, including the DIA, the CIA, NASA, and Army Intelligence. Jeffrey Mishlove, PhD, is the recipient of the only doctoral diploma in the world from an accredited university in parapsychology. He's also the grand prize winner of the Bigelow Institute essay competition regarding post-mortem survival of human consciousness. He is the author of several books, including The Roots of Consciousness, Psi Development Systems, The PK Man, and the New Thinking Aloud Dialogue series, Is There Life After Death? And UFOs and UAP, Are We Really Alone? Hi, Jeffrey and Russell. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast. We're going to be talking about the book. It's called Russell Targ, 90 Years of Remote Viewing, ESP and Timeless Awareness. Can you tell us, Russell, Jeffrey, how did this all start for you?
Well, I've known Russell for a long time, probably close to 50 years. In fact, over 50 years. And as I recall, it was last October or so, I was on the phone with Russell, and he was telling me that his 90th birthday is coming up. This year, April 11th, as I recall. And I thought to myself, gee, I've got like 15 interviews on the New Thinking Aloud YouTube channel with Russell. We could publish them all in a book, and it would be something like a Festschrift to honor him for his amazing career in parapsychology on his 90th birthday. And Russell agreed, and then we got the agreement of White Crow Books, based in the UK, and the book was just released last month.
And it's a fascinating book, and it's kind of transcripts of the interviews you did.
In looking at the book, it seems to me that I give people information about how to quiet their minds and that they can indeed see into the distance and see into the future. And it's no harder to see into the future than it is to see into the distance. So it could not be, psychic abilities could not be an electromagnetic effect. We've even done remote viewing from a submarine submerged 500 feet in the Santa Catalina Channel. And they did just as well underwater as they do in the laboratory. The Russians have believed it's low-frequency electromagnetic, low-frequency ELF, and we are convinced definitely that it's not that, that it's a direct mind-to-mind. The consciousness transcends space and time, that we live in a universe that allows consciousness to have access to anything in the universe.
When it started out for you, were doing a magic show, and you were asked to pick out tickets from a bowl, and the two tickets you picked out were really couldn't have been predicted.
That's right. I was about 14 years old doing a magic show for an art opening of a John Grove who just came back from the war. And my father published his book of paintings from the war. He worked with Ernie Pyle, the war correspondent. And I was the entertainment. So after I was done, the artist's wife gave me a big goblet full of basically theater tickets, pull out one and the lucky person will get a painting. And she stirred them up and I stirred them up and I pulled out a ticket. My vision is very poor, so I couldn't read what the ticket number is. So I gave it back to Anne and she read off this 5-digit number. Is it whose ticket is that? And nobody said anything. So I finally looked into my jacket and pulled out my ticket. And the one that I had in my hand matched the one that she has in her hand. So I managed to reach into this fishbowl of 200 tickets and pull out my ticket as a winning ticket. And everybody groaned and said, that's not fair. And Anne said, well, we can give away another painting. Russ, why don't you reach in and pull out another ticket? We stirred up the tickets and I reached in and pulled out my father's ticket. And I have both of those paintings on the wall of my office now. The beautiful watercolor of a soldier giving a Dutch girl candy and a even more beautiful bullfight picture. So I have both of them on my wall as a memento to synchronicity. Magic has a way of occurring. That is, there's no explanation for how I was able to pull out those tickets.
It's not like it's ESP or something psychic that drove you and you thought, that's the one, is it? Is you just kind of picked it out. It was completely random. But the universe was doing something?
Jung has several books on synchronicity, pointing out things that occur purposeful but random. The greatest synchronicity in my life is my decision to give up or move out of lasers. I had done laser work for 15 years, very successfully, and I just built a 1,000-watt carbon dioxide laser, which was very celebrated at the time, which was about 1970. And I had always been interested in psychic abilities and knew that one day I'd make a transition from doing laser physics to ESP research. But I was aware that all the nice researchers in psychic abilities were educated, PhDs, and very poor. There's no way to make a living. I grew up during the Depression, and one of the things I learned is that I didn't want to be poor. So I never set my educational goals toward being a ESP researcher. I thought that if I am successful in lasers, which were just invented then one day I could make a transition. And that was on my mind. And I was invited to a conference on speculative technology by NASA. I was invited to that because a NASA administrator had attended a talk that I gave for Michael Murphy, who's the head of Esalen. I knew Mike Murphy, and he called me one day and said, I'm sick of the dog. I can't give my talk at Grace Cathedral. Will you give your talk about Russian-American and ESP like you did at Esalen? Could you do that at Grace Cathedral? And I said, yes, I can do that for you. So I gave my talk at Grace Cathedral. And the last person there was a gentleman who walked up to me and said, my name is Art Reitz. I'm the head of new projects at NASA. Would you like to come to a conference I'm having on speculative technology at St. Simon's Island? So that's a big coincidence. I never heard of Art Reitz and never heard of the conference. So I went to the conference with my ESP teaching machine, a four-choice electronic device that gives you feedback and reinforcement. And I wanted to show that off because on my mind was to get support from NASA. So one of the first people who saw this machine and liked it was Wernher von Braun. And he played with this machine and did very successfully. He rang the bell again and drew a crowd. And he told me privately that he was involved in psychic research his entire life. His grandmother was psychic. And I have come to understand that everybody in ESP has a psychic grandmother. But Von Braun was very successful. And I told him that I was interested in getting a contract from NASA to teach astronauts how to get psychically in touch with their spacecraft so you could avoid accidents like they had on Apollo 13. Apollo 13 was a spacecraft that took off with a defective oxygen tank, which they didn't know about. But if they were in touch with the spacecraft, they would have fixed it before they took off. So Von Braun totally understood what I wanted to do, thought that'd be a good idea, and immediately took me to meet Jim Fletcher, who's the administrator of NASA, and said, Targa's built many lasers for NASA. We know who he is. He wants to use a ESP teaching machine to help astronauts get in touch with their spacecraft. Now, I realized that that's a crazy-sounding thing to do, but as Isaac Asimov says in Foundation, nothing has to be true, just has to sound true. And for some reason, that sounded true as I spoke to Von Braun and Jim Fletcher, and they allowed me to start a program at SRI. My friend Hal Puthoff was at SRI, but he was doing laser stuff. So Hal and I were able to get together with the administrator, with the president of SRI, and Edgar Mitchell, carrying the message that NASA will give us $80,000 to do a program. And Hal and I and Edgar Mitchell met with Charlie Anderson, and we were able to start a program. And that really illustrates the concatenation of coincidences. From Mike Murphy getting sick to Art Reese coming to my talk at the church and my meeting with Wernher von Braun. Without that chain of coincidences, we would never have started the money, because the first money we got to start a program at SRI was this $80,000 from NASA. That gave us credibility. So people often ask, well, how did you start? You guys are just physicists. How were you able to start an ESP program with no money, no sponsors, and no training in psychology? And there is no explanation, but I had a lot of intentionality. I was then 40 years old with a house and three children. Palo Alto. So I was willing to give up my laser career with the chance of possibly starting an ESP laboratory. But it turns out I was able to do that, and that ESP lab ran successfully for 20 years doing psychic things, teaching people in the Army and the CIA how to get in touch with their psychic abilities.
I just wanted to say for the listeners there that you talked about Wernher von Braun. He was in charge of the rocket program at NASA that built the Saturn V that went to the moon, and Edgar Mitchell went to the moon, didn't he? He was one of the astronauts, and also SRI is at Stanford Research Institute.
Exactly. Von Braun when I met Edgar Mitchell, he had just returned from the moon having done an ESP experiment. So Edgar Mitchell was always interested in psychic abilities, as was Von Braun. So we had a couple of ringers in our partnership, people who had a lifetime interest in this subject.
So how did this process of remote viewing originate?
Well, you can't see my office here. On the wall, I have a big picture of Padmasambhava, who in the 8th century wrote a book called Self-Liberation Through Seeing with Naked Awareness. And Padmasambhava is the guru who brought Buddhism from India to Tibet. He's a teacher who created Tibetan Buddhism, and he was also a great promulgator of the idea that our nature is timeless awareness. That is, if you quiet your mind, you can achieve self-liberation, which he means the ability to move through space and time independent of temporal distance. He said you can see into the future even though that violates our laws of cause and effect. So that was quite a surprising thing to have somebody writing about cause and effect in the 8th century. But he has a chapter in his book, which I want to reach over and show you, the self-liberation through seeing with naked awareness, which he means by naked awareness, timeless awareness. You quiet your mind and your awareness can be one with the universe. So psychic abilities is not new age. Even Patanjali wrote about this in the 2nd century BC. He talks about single-pointed focus of awareness allows you to see into the distance, see into the future, diagnose illnesses, and heal the sick. So that's a 4th century writing from Patanjali. That's probably the earliest specific writing I know about where someone gives you instruction on how to do a meditation to experience and manifest psychic abilities. So what we're doing had a great collection of antecedents, and I was quite familiar with all of these people. That I was a Buddhist and a member of the Theosophical Society, great fan of Helena Blavatsky, who herself was very psychic. Just talking about Blavatsky, she was aware in 1890, in the 1890s, that there was already a thing created called the periodic table of the elements. And that was just created. And she said, we should create a psychic periodic table of the elements. And she got Annie Besant and Charles Leadbeater, two of the great psychics who are part of the Theosophical Foundation, asked them to look at a block of paraffin and see what the structure of paraffin was. Because she knew, or somebody told her, the paraffin was 99% hydrogen and 1% carbon, like H52C2 would be the chemical formula. So tons of hydrogen comprising the bulk of such a block of wax. What did I call it before? There's no name for a block of wax.
You mean the paraffin?
Paraffin, thank you. Annie Besant drew a triangular symbol with balls at each of the three corners, and those balls were then connected by wiggly lines. The lines, she said, these are lines of force that hold the balls together. And she said those balls are fundamental atomic units. And so this triangular unit connected by energy lines was her drawing, which I published recently from her book, Occult Chemistry. And her drawing exactly corresponds to the drawing made in 1935 by Murray Gell-Mann in Princeton with his sketch of what what fundamental atoms would look like, what quarks. So the invention of quarks in 1935 exactly corresponded to what Eddie Besant drew. And when I say exactly, I mean that her drawing of a triangle with balls at the apex and wiggly lines connecting the balls, representing lines of force, she was able to visualize in 1895, and I have the photograph of the draw of the drawing from Archaeochemistry, which is a published book. In fact, when I first joined the Theosophical Society, they knew I was a physicist. So even though quarks had just been invented, they could show me drawings of quarks from Murray Gell-Mann and compare them with Eddie Besant 50 years before. And they're congruent drawings. Both represents the same kind of triangle with balls at the corner, and the balls are held together by these lines of force, exactly as Eddie Besant said. And this is an example of somebody having... We don't know how she got that information. That is to say, her experience is she closed her eyes and focused on what she saw in this bar of paraffin, and she never got feedback. She died before quarks were invented. So she did not look into the future, look at her feedback. She had some kind of direct perception or direct experience of quarks. In this, obviously, she can't see quarks, which have a mass of 10 to the minus 10th grams and are not visible to anybody. So we don't know where she got that drawing from. But we know she did that, and it's been public, and other people have done similar things with the Theosophical Society. The Theosophical Society has as its goal, according to Eddie Besant, to seek and explore the latent abilities of mankind and to develop those abilities. So it's not a deist organization. There's nothing about God in the Theosophical Society. They want to develop the latent abilities of human beings. So they were very happy to have me join them, because that's what I was interested in. I had just left Columbia, where I was a graduate student in physics, and I left to work with Gordon Gould on the development of the first laser. We did not develop the first laser, but we were working on the problem and were early practitioners of laser science and doing things with lasers. This is in the late 1950s.
Could I ask Jeffrey about a remote viewing exercise you did where you saw some wire hangers? Could you tell us how that came together?
Thank you, Simon. That occurred in 1976. In fact, it was February in my recollection. And Russell had invited me to come to SRI and learn about the remote viewing that they were doing. I was at the time a graduate student in parapsychology, and the remote viewing research was getting off the ground at that time. And I showed up, and the first thing they did, which impressed me quite a bit, was took me out to lunch at the SRI cafeteria, which was several cuts above any of the student cafeterias that I had been experiencing at Berkeley. It was a very elegant lunch, and then we went up into their laboratory, into a sealed room with thick walls and what is known as a Faraday cage that would prevent any electromagnetic signals from penetrating the room, so that if I had wanted to cheat by having a Confederate with a radio telling me what the target was, it wouldn't have worked. And Russell went into the room with me and asked me simply to close my eyes and ask my unconscious mind to give me permission to have mental imagery about the target. And the target was a remote location that one of the other experimenters, a woman named Elizabeth Rauscher, a physicist, had gotten into her car and had driven somewhere within a half hour or so from the laboratory. And I was to describe where she was.
I was given instructions that were chosen randomly from a pool of 60 possible places. And I did not know the places in the pool, so that I could assist Jeffrey by talking to him, because I couldn't give him any clues because I didn't know anything. So in remote viewing, the setup is there's a viewer like Jeffrey, somebody is an outbound experimenter demarcating a distant place, and an interviewer who worked with the viewer to try and keep him on the track of remote viewing and avoid guessing and naming. Even Padmas and Baba says that naming and guessing is the enemy of psychic functioning. He knew that in the 8th century.
I, of course, didn't know it at the time, and I began naming and guessing right away. I had a mental image in my mind and drew a picture of it, and the picture actually is a perfect match to the actual target. But in my mind, when I interpreted what I had seen and drew, I came up with a completely different interpretation. I imagined that I was looking at a rack of hangers in a clothing store, where in effect what I was actually looking at and had drawn a very good image of was a highway overpass.
The part that the interviewer played is that Jeffrey said, I'm looking at Macy's department store. And what I knew for a fact is that does not sound like remote viewing. People in remote viewing don't name the place. They don't have information to name the place. So if they're naming the place, they're reaching out and probably doing the wrong thing. So as an interviewer, I'm allowed to say something like, Macy's department store could be the target, but naming it doesn't sound like remote viewing. Why don't you tell me what you're experiencing that makes you see Macy's? Tell me about the surprising images in your awareness. What are you experiencing? And I can say, oh, only you know what you're experiencing. So you can't do this wrong, because what I'm asking you to do is to tell me about the experience you have that makes you say Macy's. And Jeffrey could then finish drawing his nested coat hangers, which extremely closely resemble what this steel pedestrian overpass made of. What do they call the open wire frames that this is made of?
I suppose it's a kind of cage going over the walkway, isn't it?
Exactly.
It was a cyclone fence.
Yes. So Jeffrey made a very good representation of the cyclone fencing where Elizabeth was hiding. Now, and that was his, of course, very first trial. In my career, I was at SRI for a decade. I almost always had success with a viewer coming in who's asked either wishes to see something in the future or wants to test our protocol. And if I have somebody sitting in a chair opposite me, I can generally help him manifest a correct representation of the distant place he's trying to see.
So you're doing this work at SRI and you've got funding from NASA. So how did the CIA and the Army become involved?
Well, when Uri Geller came along, who was doing very high quality telepathy with us, NASA got in, CIA got interested and supported us to do a little program, which we did with NASA and published that in Nature magazine, where we had what looks like a magic trick. We had 60 envelopes with simple drawings of automobiles, airplanes, mountains, crosses, a simple thing you can draw with a magic marker. There's 60 drawings. And I didn't know what those were. You never want the interviewer to know anything. So they had, what would happen is I would go into the departmental office, they'd open the safe, operate a random number generator, give me a number from 1 to 60, and then the test secretary would pull out an envelope corresponding to that number, and I would put the envelope in my jacket pocket and go and sit with Uri and say, I have an envelope here with a picture. I don't know what it is, but I would like you to draw the picture that I have in my envelope. And we did about 20 of those with Geller. And we published the whole set in Nature because Geller did extremely well in one of the targets with a bunch of grapes. So he even had the correct number of grapes. And we once had a cross, and he drew a Jewish star to go at the cross. So he had a very, very successful group. And we would consider, at the time, we considered that a clairvoyance experiment, direct contact with the target. Today, I would consider it a precognition experiment in which he quieted his mind, and the closest he would come to the target was seeing it 10 minutes in the future. So I could say, instead of asking him to do something totally impossible, that is, describing the object in my jacket, a better thing to ask him is, describe the object I'm going to put in your hand 10 minutes from now, because I believe that that's what he was doing.
So is it the CIA saw this and thought, hang on, we could use this for spying?
That's right. And we did that for a decade, and the CIA, when we started working with Pat Price, one of the places he looked, he was given coordinates that were supposed to be of a log cabin in the hills of Virginia. And it just happened that log cabin was just over the hills from the NSA listening post at Sugar Grove. NSA is National Security Agency, which is America's most secret organization, who listened in on American and Soviet communications. They were a giant listening post, snooping on the world's electronic communication. And instead of describing the log cabin, Pat Price found the secret building right near the log cabin. It was a whole facility, and he described this as some sort of military base with roll-up doors, and jeeps could go in and out of the building. And in the basement of the building, there's a filing cabinet with all their information. And he was able to tell us the name of the program and half a dozen of the individual top secret projects that are underway. And nobody thought that that was a good thing to do. And they thought that there was a breach of security. However he did it, he revealed the names of these top secret programs. And Pat Price did that early in our program. And the CIA was always very nervous about Price because you have a random man out in the public who is able to look into the heart of your most secret place and tell people what's going on. So within 6 months, the CIA hired Pat Price away from us and took him to live in on a farm in Virginia. And he died shortly after that under mysterious circumstances. It's as though the CIA had in their hands, Superman was working for them, but there was no control over Superman. As he could see anything, he could look into your office at the CIA and read what you were doing. In fact, he did that very thing as a demonstration for Kit Green, who was the super administrator of our program. We were on the telephone with Kit Green and Pat Price, and Kit said, "I have a book in front of me. Can you tell me what I've got?" And Price said, "Well, it looks like scrambled eggs, and there's something about architecture written in green ink." And in fact, Kit Green, who was a doctor, had opened a book on the anatomy of the brain, and he had written in green ink, architecture of the brain, in big letters across the top of the page. And Price was able to read the word architecture from 3,000 miles away. And that scared the hell out of everybody at the CIA, because it meant that all of the top secret books stuffed in your bookcase in your file could be read by this retired policeman. So in a sense, he demonstrated that nothing is safe, that you've got these top secret documents hidden away, revealing who you're snooping on, who you've killed, so forth, and it's all totally available. So he hired Price, and within 4 months, he was dead.
But was there a viewing that Pat Price did with some water towers and a swimming pool? But there was something weird about it, to do with the time when these things were built?
Yeah, our very first experiment in our formal series, my partner, Hal Putoff, went to a randomly selected target, which was the swimming pool complex at Rinconada Park, which is about 5 miles from SRI. And I, of course, didn't know anything about that. So I'm sitting with Price for our trial number one. And I say, "Well, Hal and Kit Green have gone to hide someplace in the San Francisco Bay Area. Could be any place, half hour drive from here. Can you tell me what you see? What are you experiencing with regard to where they are?" And Price said, "I don't know what you're talking about. I never did anything like that. I had psychic experiences as a policeman, but I never had to find someone like that." So I said, "Well, you know that Hal has this green Honda." So Hal and Kit Green drove out of the parking lot. And you see the car, you see Hal's car driving out of the parking lot. And he said, "Oh, yeah, I can do that." And they're heading south on Middlefield Road, and they turn into what looks like a park. But I see a lot of water. Maybe it's a water purification plant. There's a rectangular pool of 60 by 80 and a big round pool of 100 feet in diameter, all of which is totally correct, evidently. The numerical size of the pools are correct. And he said, "And there's two giant water tanks on pillars behind those pools of water. So I'm sure it's a water purification plant." And if you see the drawings or the photographs, you can see that the pools of water, this rectangular pool and the round pool, are right where they put them, and they are sized correctly. And the two water tanks are in the photograph that I show, because the water tanks used to be right where I put them. But no one knew that until 5 years after Price died, the city of Palo Alto published a picture book of what Palo Alto used to look like 100 years ago, a centenary celebration. So when they showed Rinconada Park, there were no swimming pools there, but there were two large water tanks on 75-foot towers, which were probably the tallest thing in Palo Alto at the turn of the century. So Price saw these water tanks that had been there, put them in the right place, had them the right size, but they were no longer there at the time of our experiment. So somehow their remains, their vibrations, he was somehow able to see those water, he never got feedback. He got feedback from the swimming pools. We took him to the park and showed him the round pool and the rectangular pool, and we considered that a hit. And we thought that the experience of the water tanks was some kind of analytical overlay, which is what Engel would call memories and guessing of a target, based on what you are able to see psychically. So the idea is that he psychically saw the two swimming pools and decided that it was a water purification plant. Because his experience was sort of as a city planner, a policeman, and a contractor, the water purification plant is something that comes immediately into his awareness. Even though that hadn't been there for 75 years.
So this remote viewing is not restricted to time. It's possible to see things in the past that are no longer there. Did that make you feel like you wanted to experiment with viewing into the past at all?
No, it's hard to do experiments into the past because as scientists, you can't tell whether they're looking into the past or looking at their feedback. Stephen Schwartz did a lot of experiments. He's an anthropologist, archaeologist, and he had people, can you view there used to be a church here, can you view what it looked like? And in some cases, the person would draw an amazingly accurate rendition of what the church looked like as reflected from earlier drawings or reflected from what they dug up. But the point is that, let's say, I'm making this up now, let's say there's a 16th century chapel that was built someplace. And nothing is there now. It's now a green pasture. And he said, there used to be some kind of chapel here. Can you see what it looked like? And the guy would then make a drawing which uniquely represented the building that used to be there. And if you want to say that was a good job, that means you have to have some other information stored away that makes you feel that he had contact with the thing. But if you can't give him feedback, then you don't know that he's done anything. So so that's the general problem with looking into the future. If you want to avoid feedback, you have to kill the viewer before the feedback is discovered. In the cases of Schwartz's having his viewer describe what was built here, what the chapel looked like, in most of the cases, the viewer died before the pictures or the excavation was done. So the viewer did not get... The point of the story is the viewer could not get feedback from the information that was eventually discovered because he had already died. So we know that he was looking into the past to see the target. So we did not do that kind of experiment because you've got to kill the viewer after the description. Otherwise, you can't tell whether it's precognition or direct view of the future of the past. Is that reason? Is that clear?
Yeah, yeah.
So the answer to your question is we would have people look into the future, which they can do excellently. They describe the picture, and then they get feedback. And I have had many precognitive dreams that are very sharp, and I'm able to tell my wife when I wake up that I get this very sharp dream. Come and sit with me by my computer, and I'm going to look at my mail, look at the New York Times, and see what the source of this dream is. And I have a collection of very sharp dreams that are replicated by either the New York Times or my mail from a colleague. So I'm totally convinced that we have direct access to the future. That is, I'm, even though we're talking about ESP, I definitely am still a physicist who believes in causality. So if I have a dream that is not self-generated from the noise in my brain, then I believe it must be caused by something. And in these cases of very sharp dreams, it's obviously caused by the picture that I see in the morning. The things that I see in the morning are very, very unusual. One case I dreamt about, a voice told me, they showed me the New York Times, the voice said there's a big picture of a European artist in this issue. And that was so unusual. And I would never dream about, first of all, you can't read in the news psychically. And this is a piece of analytical information that I hardly even could think of to tell my wife what I dreamt about. But I said, a picture of some European impressionist in the New York Times. So I clicked open my computer and went to the front page of the New York Times, and there was a half-page story on the anniversary of Pablo Picasso with a big picture of Picasso in a striped shirt. So that's not something that would be floating in my memory. I'm not thinking about Picasso. And it's very rare for any pictures of people on the front page of the Times anyway. So I have to believe that the cause of my dream was the feedback I got from my 28-inch monitor here with a full-size picture of Picasso right in front of my face. I believe that that experience of the picture of Picasso is what caused the memory, which caused the dream.
Do you feel that anybody can do this? You don't have to be born with some talent for being psychic?
I think anybody can do simple remote viewing, such as we did. That is, our bread and butter experiment would be somebody from the government says, we're thinking about supporting your program. I wanted to do a remote viewing program with the Army to broaden our base of viewers rather than work with our little collection of psychics at SRI. So I proposed to the Army that we teach half a dozen of their people to do remote viewing. And out of the six people, we chose six people out of a group of 30 that they offered us. One of those people happened to be Joe McMonagall, who is now one of the greatest psychics we've ever seen. But I just chose him off the floor of the gymnasium because he was an Army officer who said he would like to work on a psychic program. He'd never done anything like that, but he certainly said he had seen a lot of psychic things in his life, and he described some of those to me. So based on what he had experienced as a soldier, in the psychic realm, I chose him to be with us, and he turned out to be a uniquely psychic individual. And I chose six people altogether. Four of them turned out to be statistically significant in formal trials. So if you take the, you can take the whole group that I took, four people were super successful, two of them never caught on, but the successful people so outweighed the unsuccessful people that our six trials were highly significantly, odds of one in a million, publishable outcome with unselected army people. Now, they volunteered, so that all the people who volunteered thought there was something like psychic ability that they had in their lives, but they'd never done anything like remote viewing. But four of them turned out to be outstanding.
Well, it's been fascinating talking to you. The book's called Russell Targ, 90 Years of Remote Viewing, ESP, and Timeless Awareness. And people can get that on Amazon, can't they?
Yes, and in the book you have many of my conversations with Jeffrey Mishlove, which give an idea of how you can quiet your mind, look into the future, look into the distance, and make use of your own psychic abilities. So I encourage people to manifest remote viewing in addition to reading about it.
And could I ask both of you to tell us about your other books?
Well, this book was the second book in the New Thinking Aloud Dialogues series published by White Crow Books. The first book in the series was called Is There an Afterlife? Do We Survive Death? And once again, it contains transcripts from about eight or nine New Thinking Aloud interviews on the topic of survival after death. The third book in the series will be coming out in, I think, a month or two. And it's about Are We Really Alone? And it contains eight interviews with New Thinking Aloud guests on the topic of extraterrestrial encounters and the UFO phenomena. Of course, Russell has written many, many other books, most of them about the topic of ESP or timeless awareness.
And was the last book called Third Eye Spies? Is that right?
Yeah, Third Eye Spies is my last book. And it's really a summary of what we saw in our program at SRI with instructions about how to work with another person to cultivate psychic ability by simple experiments you can do with a trusted friend who will bring you targets and you learn to describe what they've brought to you. So it's a very, very simple replication of what we were doing in the laboratory at SRI. And that book is called Third Eye Spies. And I should say I have a movie of the same name, Third Eye Spies. The two-hour film with the reason I made the movie is I had the cooperation of my two contract monitors from the CIA, that is Kit Green and Ken Kress, were on camera saying, yes, we were there with Russell, and we had some ESP show up, and it was actually useful. So it's very hard to get the CIA to testify to anything, let alone endorsing a film. So because of their endorsement, I decided to make this film, which we did a few years ago. And the movie is called Third Eye Spies, and it's widely available, and is now widely available free on many of the streaming services.
Fantastic. Well, thanks again for coming on the podcast. It's been fascinating.
I'm happy to be with you. You had lots of good questions.
Thanks.
Thank you, Simon. It's been a pleasure.
And that was an interview with Jeffrey Mishlove and Russell Targ about their book, Russell Targ, 90 Years of Remote Viewing, ESP, and timeless awareness. And a great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can get exclusive access to the extended version of this episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienUFOpodcast. If you join the $2 a month tier, you get an extended episode every month. If you join the $5 a month tier, you'll have access to an extended episode every week. And when you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And if you want to try out the extended episodes, you can now get a 7-day free trial. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, and in my work as a clinical hypnotherapist, I take people through past life regression, and I'm offering a free consultation call which can be booked on my website. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review, and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening. And it was Joe McGonagall who did the remote viewing of the submarine factory, wasn't it?
One of the things that Joe McGonagall was asked to do is a task that he had from the Army. This is a large Russian building that's going up very large.